Ekatra Podcast Conversations for the Curious Essential Knowledge Simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Ekatra AI. Welcome to the deep dive.
Today we're plunging into a topic that, well, everyone experiences, but maybe doesn't always understand fully. Human sexuality.
That's right. And we're using Véronique Mottier's book, Sexuality, the Key Concepts, kind of as our guide. It's a really important work.
It is. It's quite a critical deep dive we're undertaking here.
Yeah. And our mission really is to try and dismantle this common idea that sexuality is just some fixed biological thing inside us.
Right. Like it's just there.
Exactly. We want to uncover how history, culture, even politics have sort of built the ideas we have now about desire, identity, and what's considered normal.
It sets you up for a real aha moment, I think, because the main question the book asks is, well, it's pretty provocative. Why do we think about sex the way we do? Where did these ideas actually come from?
So if you listening have ever just assumed that things like heterosexual or homosexual are just timeless facts of nature, well, get ready.
Yeah, prepare for a bit of a shakeup.
We're definitely moving beyond the common sense stuff here, trying to give you a more nuanced look at something really fundamental to being human.
So maybe we should start with the author, Véronique Mottier.
Good idea. Who is she?
Well, she's a highly distinguished academic, political science, sociology. Mm. She's held positions at places like the University of Lausanne. She was a fellow at Cambridge. Very well regarded in critical theory circles.
And that background, political science and sociology, that's really key, isn't it? It drives the whole book's perspective.
Absolutely. She's not looking at it like a doctor focused on biology or, you know, a psychologist looking at the individual mind.
She's coming at it as a political sociologist. That changes everything.
It really does. It lets her analyze sexuality not just as some private personal thing, but as a public issue, a political one.
Like a place where society governs and regulates people.
Exactly. How populations are managed, classified. And that's why she draws so heavily on Michel Foucault.
The French philosopher.
Yeah. His ideas about power are sort of the theoretical backbone here, seeing sexuality as tied up with power structures.
What I found really impressive, actually, is how she takes all these complex academic debates. I mean, you've got 19th century sexology, the feminist sex wars from the 80s, modern queer theory.
A lot.
It is a lot, and she synthesizes it. She gives you the tools without making you read, like, 50 years of dense academic papers. It's quite accessible.
Okay, so let's get to the core argument. The big idea. Mottier basically argues that sexuality, it's a social and historical construct.
Meaning not something inherent, like eye color.
Exactly. Not something you just discover, like it was always there in your DNA. It's something that's been created, defined over time by history, by language, by systems of power.
And the book traces this back, starting in the late 19th century.
Right. She pinpoints that period as kind of the birth of sexuality, as this thing that science could study. Before then, people had sex, sure. But they didn't really have a sexuality defining their core being.
Which immediately challenges that common idea, what does she call it? The repressive hypothesis.
Yes, the repressive hypothesis. That's the widespread belief that the Victorian era was all hush-hush about sex. Prudish, silent, just lots of no.
Forbidden.
Right. But Mottier, following Foucault, says, not quite.
It was the opposite.
In a way, yes. Not silence, but an explosion of talk about sex. Detailed, obsessive discourse. Doctors, priests, psychiatrists, legal experts all suddenly need to catalog, classify, medicalize every kind of sexual behavior.
Oh, wait. So talking about it more, how did that work?
Well, this intense classification, it didn't just describe desires that were already there.
Mm-hmm.
It actually manufactured new kinds of people, new categories.
That's the key mechanism then.
That's the absolute pivot. It shifted things from being about sinful acts, like you did something forbidden, to being about inherent personality types. Medical conditions, almost.
Giving us labels like?
The homosexual. The pervert. The person themselves became the diagnosis, defined by their desires.
Okay, let's break that down a bit more. The invention part. Because that really is the core, isn't it? You've got essentialism.
Right. That's the idea that desire is, you know, natural, biological. A universal drive, like being hungry. It just is.
And then the other side is social constructionism, which is Mottier's view.
Yeah. And that argues that how we understand desire, how we categorize it, talk about it, what meaning we give it, that's all shaped by specific times and places, by culture, by history.
So, before the late 1800s, if someone engaged in same-sex behavior,
They were seen as committing a sin, maybe a crime, defined by religious law, legal codes. It was about the action.
But then came sexology. People like Krafft Ebing, Havelock Ellis.
And they took that behavior, which was judged by priests or judges, and turned it into a medical or psychological issue.
So, from sin and crime.
To perversions, things to be diagnosed, studied, maybe even cured.
That shift in thinking, it's huge for understanding today, isn't it?
Absolutely crucial. It moved from judging what you did, a behavior you could, in theory, stop, to defining who you were, an inherent identity, possibly pathological.
So the person doing same-sex acts wasn't just a sinner anymore, they were a whole different type of person.
A homosexual, a distinct species almost. Their entire being suddenly defined by this medicalized desire.
I want to go back to the power aspect because the Foucault influence is so strong here. When we talk about his critique of that repressive hypothesis and this idea of productive power or biopower, maybe unpack that a bit for someone new to the term.
Okay, yeah, good point. Usually we think power just means saying no, prohibition, the state stopping you from doing things. That's repressive power.
Right, don't do that.
Productive power is, well, it's sneakier. It's the power that actually creates the things it ends up controlling. It generates knowledge. It defines what's normal. It produces subjects in neat categories.
So it's not just forbidding things, it's actively creating the rules of the game. Like, here are the five approved ways to be sexual.
Exactly. And if you're outside those, you're now this other thing, this deviation we've named and classified.
Okay, I get it.
Think about modern public health campaigns, sex ed in schools. The state isn't just banning stuff, it's categorizing people, managing birth rates, defining safe sex. It's managing the population, the species that's biopower.
Managing life itself.
Right. And by constantly talking about sex, analyzing it, writing detailed reports, the authorities gain this incredible ability to manage citizens right down to their intimate lives.
And that intense focus on anything non-procreative, that's what Foucault termed the perverse implantation.
Yes. All this talk ended up creating this huge divide.
Yeah.
You had the normal, the married baby-making couple, and then this vast sprawling world of the perverse constantly being examined and categorized.
And this medical framing, it was definitely meant as a way to control and stigmatize people,
Yeah.
right?
Oh, absolutely. It was intended to pathologize anyone who didn't fit the procreative heterosexual norm.
But, and here's the twist, the big paradox that seems to drive so much modern identity politics. By naming and defining the homosexual as this distinct type of person, didn't that accidentally create the very identity that a political movement could later rally around?
That is the profound double-edged sword of it all.
Yeah.
Yes. The very category created for control became a potential site of resistance.
So when the gay liberation movement really took off after Stonewall,
They strategically flipped the script. They often adopted an essentialist argument, "We were born this way," precisely to demand rights and recognition
taking the label meant to pathologize them.
and turning it into a flag, a basis for political community and action. It's fascinating.
But hang on, if they use that fixed identity for rights, then what about queer theory? Because that seems to push back against all fixed categories, even gay or straight.
Ah, yes. Queer theory, influenced heavily by thinkers like Judith Butler.
Yeah.
It critiques that very reliance on stable identities. The argument is that by demanding inclusion within existing categories like gay or straight, we actually end up reinforcing the power system that created those limiting boxes in the first place.
So queer theory wants to.
Deconstruct the binaries altogether. Emphasize fluidity, performance. Resist labeling entirely rather than just trying to make the labels okay.
Wow. So you have this tension, the political need for a stable identity versus the theoretical desire to dissolve identities. That's huge.
It is. And that whole contested nature of what liberation even means, it brings us neatly to the infamous feminist sex wars of the 1980s.
Right, a classic example of how messy liberation can be.
Totally. It was a really bitter divide within feminism. On one side, you had anti-pornography or radical feminists, think Catherine MacKinnon, Andrea Dworkin.
And their view was.
They saw things like pornography, BDSM, even prostitution, as fundamentally structures of male dominance, patriarchal oppression, basically.
Yeah.
They seriously questioned if genuine consent was even possible in a society built on inequality.
So certain sexual acts themselves were seen as inherently harmful to women.
Pretty much. But then you had the sex-positive feminists like Gail Rubin or Carol Vance, who pushed back hard.
What was their argument?
They argued that the anti-porn view was, frankly, puritanical and risked denying women their own sexual agency, their own pleasure. They wanted to make a clear distinction between violence and consensual sexual expression, however diverse or unconventional.
They were fighting for women's right to explore their own desires.
Exactly. Even if those desires didn't fit a particular feminist or mainstream narrative.
So the big takeaway from that whole conflict is, there's no single easy definition of sexual freedom.
Not at all. For one group, liberation meant freedom from certain sexual practices. For the other, it meant the freedom to engage in them. It highlights the complexity.
Which is why Mahdi's analysis is so useful. It gives you the tools to think through these complexities. Maybe we should pull out some of the main themes, the key messages for listeners.
Good idea. Let's crystallize. The first big one has to be the denaturalization of categories.
Yeah.
The book just hammers this home. Heterosexuality, homosexuality, these aren't timeless truths found in nature. They are historical inventions created through science, law, discourse, mainly in the 19th century.
And the reflection for us today is, if they were invented, why do we still treat them as these solid, unchangeable facts?
Precisely. It makes you question the stability of all these categories we use.
Okay, theme number two.
The shift from act versus identity. We touched on this, but it's crucial. Moving from punishing a behavior
to defining a person's core being based on that behavior.
That's the pivot. And it's so relevant because our modern sense of self is often deeply tied to our sexual or gender identity, a concept that, you know, just didn't exist in the same way centuries ago.
And that shift, born out of control, ironically created the conditions for identity politics for community.
The double-edged sword again.
Okay, third theme.
How about the globalization of sexual politics?
Yes, definitely. Sexual norms aren't just local anymore, are they? They're shaped by global forces, human rights talk, international media, migration. It makes sense why things like same-sex marriage or trans rights become these huge political issues across so many different countries.
Right. The personal, the sexual, is now woven into global social organization. It confirms Mahdi's point.
Mm-hmm.
The personal is undeniably political.
You know, it might help to highlight some of the actual powerful phrases or ideas from the book. Mahdi has these really succinct ways of putting things.
Yeah, like sound bites that capture the core arguments. One that really underpins everything is, the Victorians were not silent about sex. They were obsessed with it.
That just flips the common narrative, doesn't it?
Completely. Shows power as productive creating knowledge, not just saying no.
And the key historical moment.
That would be. The invention of the homosexual as a distinct species of person was a pivotal moment. That encapsulates that whole shift from judging acts to diagnosing identities, reshaping everything.
Yeah, the sin to identity pipeline.
Mm-hmm. And then there's the paradox of activism. Identity categories provide the basis for political mobilization, but also create new forms of exclusion.
A really important reminder. Fighting for us can reinforce the line between us and them.
It keeps things complicated in a necessary way.
So bringing this all back, why does this, you know, quite dense historical and theoretical stuff actually matter for someone listening right now? What are the real life takeaways?
I think the most immediate one is potentially a huge increase in empathy and reduced judgment.
How so?
Well, if you start to grasp that categories like normal or natural aren't fixed truths, but historical constructs, it really pulls the rug out from under judging diversity. Especially thinking about trans and non-binary identities today. It suggests there's no single right way to be.
That makes sense. And for parents or educators.
Oh, it's incredibly valuable. It gives you a framework to talk about sexuality that isn't just prescriptive rules. It's about fostering critical thinking, talking about diversity, consent, rather than just repeating old, potentially harmful norms.
Shifting the conversation from what's allowed to how did we come up with these ideas anyway?
Exactly. But, and even in adult relationships, it can be transformative.
Really?
This perspective helps you see desire as potentially fluid, something constructed and communicated, not just fixed and assumed. It encourages partners to actually talk about changing needs, evolving desires over a lifetime.
Turns intimacy into more of an ongoing dialogue.
Yes, instead of static assumptions. It makes space for change.
For me, thinking about all this, the biggest takeaway is probably realizing how our most private feelings, the desires we think are just ours, are actually connected to these huge historical systems. Knowledge, power, governance.
The personal is political.
In the deepest sense, yeah. It's not just about policy, it's about how we even conceive of ourselves.
And I think the real value of Mahdi's work, ultimately, is giving us the analytical tools. Tools to see that the categories we live with, the ones we take for granted, they weren't inevitable. and they could be changed.
It's empowering in a way.
It is. She argues for what she calls a sexual democracy, which isn't just about tolerance, like, okay, you can exist. It's a demand for actual sexual justice, for challenging the inequalities that still limit people's autonomy and choices today.
A call to keep questioning what we accept as natural.
Exactly. Keep thinking critically.
See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Ekatra Foundation.